So good morning and thanks everyone for coming along today. It's great to see you all. Today we're launching the third of the Green Party initiatives. The first one was about getting kids out of poverty. The next one was about cleaning up rivers, and today we're talking about green jobs and green economic transformation. I'd like to acknowledge someone from Business New Zealand's here in the CTU. Thank you very much for coming along. As well, I think we have some people here from the Fabian Society in Forest and Bird, so it's great to see you all. And I think Nick's here from the Heavy Engineering Research Association too. Thanks everyone for coming along. What we're talking about today is green economic opportunity. So we are going through this enormous transition in terms of the global economy as we come to terms with the sustainability issues, and that creates real challenges for our economy, but it also creates real opportunities, and this is about New Zealand engaging in those real opportunities. And so the plan that I'm about to release, I'll talk through a PowerPoint very shortly, is about trying to find the ways for us to engage with those opportunities. But before I do that, I'd just like to introduce Nick Gerritsen. Nick's come along today, Nick's a green entrepreneur, one of the directors and founders of Aquaflow and various other green startup companies. In some ways, Nick epitomises the green economic opportunity, someone who's chosen to live in New Zealand, but in Marlborough Sounds, a beautiful Marlborough Sounds, but could live anywhere on the planet. And I just asked Nick to say a few words about what he's up to and what he sees as the green economic opportunities, and then I'll present the presentation behind it. So over to you, Nick.
Thanks very much. Well, it's great to be here because I guess it's one of those things occasionally in life you get a chance to actually let your conscience sort of like pass through, and that's sort of where I'm coming from. I think, you know, the key point for New Zealand is that we need to realise that the green economy is actually mainstream. And increasingly, you know, global engagement for all countries, let alone little countries on the edge of the world, is actually going to be absolutely predicated around our green credentials. So if you are a pragmatic, you know, capitalist, you know, business person wanting to sort of like come up with something from New Zealand, framing your innovation or your entrepreneurial idea within that framework is actually fundamental, I think, to being successful globally. So I guess, you know, in our particular story, we were lucky enough to have a group of people that were brave enough to look at a blank piece of paper about 6 years ago, and we sort of identified, you know, what were some of the big structural issues that we sort of saw the world moving into. And obviously, you know, constraint around fossil resources and the sort of the various techniques and methodologies used by governments around the world to try and gain an interest in those resources was obviously a key area. But even pragmatically looking back at New Zealand, it's like, well, how can New Zealand get its product to market if the cost of crude oil is $250 to $500 US a barrel? And these things are actually happening very, very fast. I think a key indicator for us recently, and it's like one of those amazing data points, which I don't think has actually been adequately covered in New Zealand, is the International Energy Agency actually admitting that the world passed into peak oil in 2006. So we're now on the downside of an exponential curve. And you know what? We're on a call recently with the World Economic Forum, Future of Aviation. The World Bank analyst said that it's highly likely that a barrel of crude oil is going to be $250 US by 2020, which is actually, unfortunately, not that many years away. So we just started doing stuff, really. Scientists hate it when I say this, but we started blowing stuff up, basically. And our real thinking was, how do we go back to nature and actually try and speed nature up? So if we think about crude oil actually came from algae that was in the oceans hundreds of millions of years ago. You know, the deserts that we're currently mining now were originally oceans, so hence crude oil in the Middle East, etc. So we thought, okay, well, what can we do? Where are there algae? The mayor of Marlborough, the Marlborough District Council, were really great. They said, here's some space, go and start doing some stuff out there. And within a relatively short period of time, and this was actually December 2008, with our partner Honeywell in Chicago, we produced the world's first fully compliant Jet A1 aviation fuel out of wild algae from the Blenheim sewage ponds. Interestingly to me, this is still the only fully compliant Jet A1 sample from wild algae in the world. So my question is, well, how smart is the world? On the other side of the fossil equation, coal, and obviously coal is becoming an increasing issue for New Zealand. How can we speed up the process of creating coal? Again, it's like a, you know, tens of millions of years sort of process, and luckily or not, we have a resource in that area, but the issues are, is it smart to use this resource unless it's at the high quality end of it? So we figured, well, let's have a go at this. In that particular case, the biomass feedstock that we took into it was actually pine sawdust waste from the forestry industry, of which, depending on who you talk to, you know, we have somewhere between 2 to 4 million tonnes per annum dumped on our landscape in New Zealand. So from that, we produced this here, which is actually an equivalent to coking coal, which actually is a key part of steel making. So this here really can potentially herald in this whole new, I guess, product sector of green steel. And already, as a small company, we are attracting significant interest from really large steel companies from around the world on that. Not to sort of like defer from blowing more stuff up, we blew it up again and came up with this here, which is activated carbon. Activated carbon is basically used for filtration, water, emissions controls. It's a market which is a multi-billion dollar global market that's compounding at about 5% growth per annum. Again, out of sawdust, we produced a product here which sells for $2,500 a tonne. So, speeding nature up, we forget the great Tim Flannery statistic or data point is that, you know, every year human society, of which we're part, uses more than 400 years of stored energy. So we're actually really lucky that the Earth is as old as it is. So by us actually endeavouring to speed things up, hopefully that differential, if we get 1%, 2%, 5% or whatever, wherever it may end up, actually will have an order of magnitude improvement on that overall ratio. So New Zealand has a key role to play in all this. It's interestingly, you know, that the visitors that we've had to these companies, probably 20% of them have been Kiwi, 80% of them have been global. Of that 80%, I would say 50% of them have been in the top 250 largest companies in the world, walking around Blenheim sewage plants, which I think is quite hilarious. You know? So my point is, if you do cool stuff, if you have big ideas, the world is actually hungry and it's watching. So, you know, I think back to the work that New Zealand did around the knowledge wave period. You know, what the green economy offers us is actually a common sense economy, which is actually the transformational opportunity that New Zealand has been wishing for. So our key issue now is that we've been a bit slow to get going onto it. So, you know, I think that the announcements that are coming out today and this whole push forward into this area has to be seen as a transformational economic opportunity for the country, which is broad and deep in just what it can do. You know, from biologists and engineers to labourers to forestry workers, you know, it actually is going to, you know, impact the entire New Zealand economy. And that's what, you know, we're really doing. We're just trying to do our bit to actually make it happen as fast as we possibly can. So, thanks.
Cool. Thanks, Nick. That was great. So that's kind of a bit of a taster for the opportunities. There's plenty more. So what I want to do next is just run through 10 areas, basically, where we think we need to make some significant changes if we are to take these kind of green economic opportunities. But firstly, what we're talking about is we're talking about whether we can have 10,000 new green jobs. Now, obviously, in terms of trying to estimate, 100,000 new green jobs, in terms of trying to estimate job numbers, some of the package we're about to release involves direct government investment, and it's pretty easy to estimate the numbers around direct government investment. But the bulk of the package is about private sector growth and private sector jobs, because that's where the bulk of the jobs need to come from. And estimating the number of jobs from the private sector is an inexact science. We know there's tremendous opportunity, but so that we're using 100,000 green jobs as a kind of overriding figure, but it could be significantly larger than that, and in the long run it has to be. The background to all of this is the global picture. So the United Nations has been pushing very hard on this, that not only do we need to make this transition, but there are lots of jobs to be gained in the process of making this transition. There are endless books. There's like a forest of books now that have come out about the clean technology sector and taking advantages of the new green economy. I mean, there's heaps and heaps more than this. Some of them from surprising sources, like Thomas Friedman, who's tends to be a very conservative economist in many respects. He's pushing very strongly about taking advantage of the new green economy and getting into it. In New Zealand, we've had the Pure Advantage Group has been promoting these issues, which is a group of leading New Zealand business people. It includes people like Rob Fife from Air New Zealand and Rob Morrison's brother Lloyd from Infratil and numerous others engaged in that process, Philip Mills, who are all pushing to say New Zealand needs to make the most of these opportunities. And of course the government has set up its own Green Advisory Group. Now, you know, we would argue that the ambition of the government's Green Advisory Group isn't good, and I saw Jan Ryders put a statement out today about the limits that were put on the terms of reference of that group. But at least it's starting. The government itself is being pushed slowly, or ever so slowly, in this direction to engage with this space. So the 10 areas I want to go through. The first is about direct government investment. What we know is that this is a very fast way to produce change, and it's necessary. So the United Nations say, look, markets are essential to it, but so is direct government investment. And so the first part of it, I just want to talk about four areas. There's more detail in the booklets we've handed out. But the first is about extending the home insulation scheme. We've done 100,000 households. We've got the budget for another 100,000. We're saying extend it to a further 200,000 households. This has very significant paybacks in terms of the investment. It's a great scheme. It's something we're very proud of, and we think it can be taken further. It has real jobs advantages as well. The second part of it is about filling some of the gaps that are currently in the shortages around housing. Before the Christchurch rebuild gets absolutely underway, which will produce significant capacity constraints in the building sector, we think that we need to use the time between now and then to actually fill some of the gaps that there are currently in state and other kinds of community sector housing. An expanded build there. The third part of it is a series of investments to protect our natural environment. This is, if you like, about brand protection, but it's not just about brand protection. I've talked a bit about the riparian fencing and planting projects, but there's a number of projects, including pest control, that are really quite essential if we are to protect the long-term viability of the New Zealand economy. And the fourth part of the direct government investment is a very small investment, but it's quite significant. It's about providing some certainty in the forestry sector. So we've seen some increase in forestry plantings, but by providing some certainty around price in the forestry sector, and there's more detail in the booklet, we can stimulate a lot of jobs in the sector and also sequester a lot of carbon. For a relatively small investment. And it's just about providing some certainty around price. This is very important for New Zealand because, as I'm sure people realise, that in 2020 we're going to run into real problems in terms of our Kyoto accounts as those forests start to be harvested. So the forestry we've planted will cover us through to 2012 in terms of sequestering emissions. But once those forests start to be harvested, we're going to have a big spike in greenhouse emissions coming out of New Zealand. So providing some certainty to the forestry sector now will help us get through that period in the early 2020s when those forests are harvested. The second area is around infrastructure, but particularly I want to talk about the energy companies. This is perhaps New Zealand's great opportunity globally, is the expansion in renewable energy globally. I mean, there's all sorts of numbers thrown around. This is currently a $400 billion a year industry. It could be an $800 billion a year industry by 2015. This is a huge opportunity for us as a country because of the expertise we have in this area. Us and Iceland obviously lead the world in terms of renewable electricity generation. Obviously, it's not just about electricity. It's about other kinds of liquid fuels as well. But we do have a specific advantage here. This is a picture where we have particular advantages, actually geothermal. This is a picture of a micro geothermal plant. This is an American built plant in Utah. But these are the kinds of plants that we actually have great ability to produce in New Zealand. So the first thing is we would argue that we need to keep the energy companies in state ownership so that we retain the ability to use them to lead this kind of economic transformation. But what we want to do with them is focus them on the export potential. So currently these energy companies, some of them are a bit focused on export, but we want to really make them look at the export potential around renewables so that we can get a piece of the global action in terms of renewable energy. And we want them to partner with private sector entrepreneurs. So we're saying keep them in public ownership, but encourage them into partnerships with the private sector. So that way we keep the headquarters in New Zealand, we keep the R&D in New Zealand, but we get the benefits that come with partnering with the private sector. And we think that's quite an important part of it. Some of the energy companies have actually been doing this, but we would encourage them to do more of it. In terms of providing capital, one of the government's arguments around privatisation of the energy companies is they needed access to capital. Actually, you don't have to privatise them to get access to capital. These companies can issue energy bonds, which would actually be very attractive to New Zealand investors who have been so burnt by the finance company disaster. And it would be a chance for people to be part of the green economic and energy revolution. We're saying target 1% of the global market. Targeting 1% of the global market, this is something, if we were to get 1% of the global renewable energy market, we're talking 40,000 to 60,000 jobs in New Zealand. It is such a large global market. If you think about dairy, we're 2% of global dairy production. We're about a third of the export market in dairy. We can be ambitious about getting a chunk of the global renewable energy market. We're nicely positioned to do it. If you think about New Zealand's GDP, we're only 0.16 of global GDP, but we could easily be 1% of this global market. It is a tremendous opportunity for our country, but we need to orient ourselves to it and embrace it. The third area that I want to talk about is SMEs. So small to medium-sized enterprises are obviously a very important part of the New Zealand economy. And one of the very critical ways that we can help those small to medium-sized enterprises is through government procurement. Actually making sure that there is a steady market for those small to medium-sized enterprises in New Zealand. So one of the first steps we'd do is actually green government procurement to give an opportunity for the small to medium-sized enterprises in New Zealand that want a red market for their products. Government has this ability. Now, obviously, in the long run, those SMEs need to look at much more than the government sector. But in the first instance, in terms of providing some kind of basic market opportunity, government can do that. We'd also offer a small startup fund, $100 million for clean technology SMEs. That's over 3 years. All the costings in here are over three financial years. One of the issues is that when you look at venture capital, Nick might want to talk more about this later, but there are gaps within the venture capital market in New Zealand. And so we need to have a little bit of government intervention to fill some of those venture capital gaps that enable companies to scale up. And finally, we think that we need to simplify the tax for micro and small business. A lot of very small businesses spend a lot of their time dealing with the IRD. The Institute of Chartered Accountants has got some really interesting and good proposals around simplifying the tax system for small business that would help them a lot. So they can spend more time turning great ideas into markets rather than filling out forms. The next one is driving innovation. If we're going to make this transition, then we need to drive green innovation, and that has to be absolutely essential, that we drive innovation right across the economy. So if you look at our spending on research and development, this is New Zealand over here. So you can see within the OECD, we're right down the bottom. 1.31% of GDP, combined government and private sector R&D spending, and this is your OECD average up here. Over 2%. So we are way behind the eight ball in terms of R&D spending. And if we stay down here, we are not going to invest in the kind of innovation that we need. So it's quite critical we improve that. So we're proposing a boost in government spending over 3 years of $1 billion in R&D. Now, that would be, whether that's delivered through tax credits or whether through grants, we're kind of agnostic. Let's just be practical about the best way to deliver it, because I know that Labor and National have got different views about how that should be delivered, but the key thing is to make sure that it is delivered and that it's matched to private sector investment as well. We also need to ramp up standards. One of the ways that we've seen driving innovation across the world has been to improve standards. I mean, California has probably been the leader in this. By improving energy efficiency standards, they've been driving up innovation. The OECD report about innovation and green technology pointed particularly to the role of standards in terms of driving innovation. So the fifth area is regulation, and making sure that we have smarter regulation and consistent regulation. The PricewaterhouseCoopers survey of CEOs, what they found was that CEOs are looking for clear, consistent government policy. So not the kind of delay and prevarication that we've seen in New Zealand just recently around climate change. We need consistent policy about it. So whether that's very consistent policy around water, or whether it's around minimum energy performance standards, and associated with that, of course, is average fuel efficiency standards, we need smart regulation that sits behind all of this and provides consistent driver to green innovation. The sixth thing is getting the price right. It's hard to underestimate how important it is to get prices right. I mean, governments can do all sorts of things. Governments can have interventions here, there and everywhere. But actually, economies like ours, a market-based economy, there are a million decisions being made today across New Zealand, and most of them are being made on the basis of price. So we need to get prices right if we are to drive the innovation. Treasury in Australia, the federal government in Australia, produced a report about getting prices right on carbon. And what they said is that economies that deferred putting in a carbon price actually have longer-term costs. Because, of course, the longer you delay, the higher the cost of adjustment. Because it means that you have all these investments that are put in place when you expected the price of carbon to be low. And then, of course, they become outdated as the price of carbon rises. The OECD has said similar things about internalising the cost of externalities. So externalities like climate change, externalities like water pollution, if we don't have prices that internalise those externalities, by internalising those externalities, rather, we can actually drive innovation. And that's one of the key points that's come out of all the studies in this area. So that's why we need a proper price on carbon around the ETS. It's why we need a proper price on the commercial use of water. It's why a waste levy has been quite important already. We've been seeing some innovation being driven around reducing waste to landfill. I was in Rotorua just yesterday, where they're doing some very interesting work about reducing waste to landfill and creating innovation and products and services that will ultimately be commercialised. And we need to look at mining and the mining royalties. New Zealand has a very low, internationally has a very low system of mining royalties, right out at the bottom of the OECD. And that means that we're not pricing our minerals properly. And it means that the future generations are essentially losing out because we're consuming the resource and there's very little being saved for the future. And I'll talk about that more in a second. The seventh element is brand protection. Brand protection, everyone talks about that, you know, clean, green New Zealand and how important it is. Actually, it is really important. I know we talk about it a lot, but it's hard to underestimate how important it is. This is a quote from Tim Grosser. Where he's talking about the risk to New Zealand is that our customers will be, if the brand is dented or damaged, that our customers will walk away from us, and particularly our retailers. We've seen that, for example, with fish in the United Kingdom. Now New Zealand fish have been banned from a number of supermarkets because of the environmentally destructive practices of the New Zealand fishing industry. So that is a real warning shot for us that we could lose market access. Likewise, the OECD has said very similar things. They've said that you shouldn't underestimate the value of our brand in a world that's becoming increasingly concerned about environmental issues. So we need to take some just basic action to protect the brand. That's about cleaning up fresh water. That's about action on greenhouse emissions because, you know, we do have one of the highest greenhouse emissions per capita around the world. It's about dealing with animal practices, farming practices. It's actually a real sensitivity in our overseas markets, the way we treat animals on our farms. And it's about ending the destructive fishing practices. That's all about protecting the clean, green and safe New Zealand brand. And it's absolutely critical that we do protect that brand. The eighth area I wanted to touch on was capital market reform. This is really important for the New Zealand economy in general, but it's also important specifically in terms of the green economy, is actually making sure that we have a competitive capital market. As Alan Bollard says here, in his couched language, because of course as Governor of the Reserve Bank, he's pretty couched, he says a lack of competition in the banking sector may have pushed up the price of credit. And of course, I think there's a lot of evidence that it has pushed up the price of credit. So the first thing is we need to strengthen Kiwibank in the banking sector to get competition. So So that means letting KiwiBank retain its earnings so that it can reinvest them and expand. It may mean a capital injection into KiwiBank, though that's probably not on the cards at the moment. It means capital gains tax, excluding the family home, to drive capital into the productive sector and out of the housing sector. It means giving the Reserve Bank more policy tools so that they don't always have to rely on interest rates when they're trying to drive down inflation. The Basel III's given the Reserve Bank a bunch of tools to deal with asset bubble inflation, which I'm happy to talk about later, but has been covered on Finance and Expenditure Committee at various times. The other one is exploring an option for KiwiSaver. We don't have a public option for KiwiSaver at the moment, so using the New Zealand Superannuation Fund as a low-cost provider of KiwiSaver. Now, the super fund wasn't set up for that purpose, because when you think about it, it was to be sold down eventually. But the super fund does have certain benefits in terms of low-cost provision of investment services. And so I think we need to look at whether that should be provided as a public option, because there isn't a public option for KiwiSaver at the moment. And finally, if we are talking about increasing the royalties from mining, one of the things that I think we need to put a line, or at least put a flag in the sand in at the moment, is about what we do with those increased royalties. Currently, we essentially consume them or spend them, and they just go into the government bottom line. Overseas, a lot of governments have started to set up reserve funds or sovereign wealth funds where a lot of the royalties from these kind of mining activities have ended up. I mean, if it were to happen that there was a very large oil find in New Zealand or some such, it's important that we don't go down the kind of Nigerian path or the UK path and just spend all the money, but actually we do create a reserve fund for future generations rather than just simply blow it all. The ninth area is about making workplaces fairer. In this transition, we need to make sure that in the transition to the green economy that we do it in a fair way, that there are decent jobs, well paid, and that's something that's certainly been at the focus of the UN. So part of it is making sure that we have decent, well-paid jobs, green jobs. Part of it is about making sure that we have a decent minimum wage, the $15 an hour minimum wage. And part of it is about strengthening collective bargaining rights. The unionism in the private sector in New Zealand is relatively weak, and we need to make sure that we strengthen collective bargaining rights to make sure that there are decent wages and conditions, and also engaging workers actually in the productive process, because the experience overseas is that, if you look at Germany, for example, having worker participation in large corporations has been immensely useful for those corporations, and Germany being one of the most successful economies on the planet. And finally, it's about measuring. If you don't measure things, you're not going to take them into account. GDP is a pretty dumb measure. It's one thing, we should keep it, but we need a bunch of other things as well. GDP by itself just doesn't tell us enough. So the OECD General Secretary, as well as President Sarkozy from France, and a list of very important people as long as my arm, have all been saying that we need alternative measures, not just GDP. And so the Greens have been promoting those. Kennedy Graham, I think he's here. Hi, Ken. Ken's put up a bill about exactly this. The idea is that you need a dashboard of indicators. GDP is one indicator, but you need a dashboard of social and environmental indicators. Treasury's done some interesting work about the social indicators quite recently, and so we've made some progress towards getting alternative indicators, but we need a dashboard of them. Finally, there's the fiscal impacts of all of this. This is looking over three financial years. There's more detail in your books rather than trying to get it off the PowerPoint, but what we've tried to do was look at our priorities. As a 10-15% party, going into negotiations after the next election, we need to prioritise about what things we're pushing for, if you like. So it's quite important for us that we are very clear when we go to the electorate what things will be prioritised to advocate for, and then in terms of getting the costings together. So you'll see the costings there are pretty conservative in terms of the government's overall fiscal position over 3 years. Of the impact of these proposals. I'm happy to go through, and maybe if people want to ask questions about the detail, but it's in the, I think it's on page 19 of the book, the detail of where those costings have come from. Yeah, page 19. But it does create a relatively conservative fiscal position. Now, obviously, in any post-election negotiation, it's not just about our priorities, and there'll be other issues on the table. There's inflation adjustments in health and education as a bare minimum, for example. So there are other cost pressures on the government, but this is costing these priorities that we've been putting forward. So finally, just to go back to the beginning, this is about opportunities. This is about New Zealand embracing the global green economic opportunities. This is about us transitioning our economy to a much more sustainable footing. And of course, behind that, the values that sit behind it, it's about making sure that we have a decent society where people get looked after and we don't have masses of poverty. It's also about looking after our natural environment, and it's also about making sure that we don't destroy the climate system on which we all depend for our very lives. And so going into this election, our priorities are going to be around we want to clean up rivers, we want to get kids out of poverty, and we want to create green jobs. And we think Kids Rivers Jobs, it's a pretty great prospect for a richer New Zealand, and that's what we'll be going into this election as our priorities. So I'll leave it there and open it up for questions and questions from the audience.
What's the total cost of the jobs package?
The total cost of the jobs package is around. So the total cost of the jobs package is around $2.5 billion, roughly speaking.
And that's for the 100,000 jobs over 3 years.
The 100,000 jobs over 3 years. There's the job stuff is, if you look at the details of the job stuff, a big chunk of it is about the renewable energy sector. And so whether that would happen over 3 years or a number of more years, we're not quite sure. Because it is necessarily an inexact science when it comes to predicting jobs in the private sector.
So it's 100,000 jobs by when?
So it would be, the target is to do 100,000 jobs over 3 years, but we're also, you've got to be realistic about it. So the renewable energy sector offers a real opportunity for lots of jobs. You could also talk about, data hosting and cloud computing. New Zealand has great opportunities in that because we've got renewable energy. Hopefully once the second fibre optic cable comes across, we'll be in a nice position around that. There's obviously there's opportunities around liquid fuels that Nick was talking about earlier, but we're just focused on the renewable energy sector in terms of trying to quantify it.
Can you make 100,000 jobs under a Labour government? Because if you take out the Saudi state-owned assets, which National would do, you come down to about 35 to 53, is that correct?
If you look at, in terms of what would be the impact if National proceeded with the partial privatisation of state-owned enterprises, clearly the partial privatisation doesn't mean they have no opportunities to engage in this global market. We just think that actually they'll be in a better position to do it if they're kept in public ownership and they partner with private. So obviously we think it would work better if they were kept in public ownership, but that doesn't mean that they can't have an orientation towards exports just because they're partially privatised.
Can you explain exactly where these jobs are going to be in the renewables? You're talking 47 to 65,000. That's a lot of people doing a lot of work. Exactly what work will they be doing?
So New Zealand has particular advantages in geothermal. That's kind of our strongest area. Remember, we started the second major geothermal plant in the world was built in New Zealand. And so those jobs are around manufacturing is a key part of it. Those jobs are around the provision of expertise and services overseas and the provision of technology overseas. We've already started building the Heavy Engineering Research Association did an interesting report looking specifically at geothermal. And what surprised me was the large number of companies, engineering companies, already deeply engaged in this space and the fact that they're already exporting this technology overseas. So that's where I think the opportunity lies. We've used multipliers in there around the impact of manufacturing in particular.
But if you export the technology and the ideas, don't the overseas people pick up the ideas and use it to develop their own economies and thereby negate what you're trying to do back here?
No. I mean, if you think about it, the opportunities are around whether you're manufacturing the components here and whether you're providing the services and the expertise over there. If you look at it in reverse, the New Zealand economy has some large overseas-owned corporations that are involved in, say, contact energy or whatever. A lot of the work that gets done in New Zealand by overseas multinationals has a big impact on those multinationals' job provision overseas, as well as in New Zealand.
Can you can you list, for someone sitting at home tonight watching, you know, watching this, can you list some of the occupations or jobs that you're talking about here?
Sure. So in terms of, if you're talking about riparian fencing and planting around direct government investment, so that's, if you like, jobs that are targeted towards the rural sector and at the relatively low skilled end. So they're, you know, level entry jobs, if you like, so that we deal with some of the unemployment issues we have in the rural sector. And the same applies to a little bit more, probably some more skilled jobs around pest control. If you look at the housing sector, there's a bunch of jobs in terms of the housing sector and the building industry. And if you look at forestry, there's a whole bunch of jobs involved in forestry planting. And then if you move to the kind of energy sector, you're talking about manufacturing jobs. You're talking about managing the technology and the services that go with electricity generation and management. We have a lot of skills around grid management in New Zealand as well.
Did you plan for education in that respect? Is there a job coming on in 3 years people will need to change skills? Do you have a tertiary plan or something like that?
There will be some. I think that, you know, and we've included a segment in there about training, a small segment about vocational training. To some degree, it's going to be a bit responsive to what particular markets or skills we need. I mean, the thing about having a private, you know, if you argue that it's a private sector that's generating a lot of the jobs, is you can't necessarily write down now exactly what jobs you're going to need, but you can say they're going to be in this area.
If there's as much potential in renewables as you seem to think there is, why aren't the SOEs then doing it already? If it's potentially so lucrative, one would assume that they'd already be doing this.
To some degree they have. So if you look at Meridian, which has probably pioneered the partnership model, whether it's WhisperTech or whether it's others, they've had a series of partnership models with other private sector, some of them to some degree more than others. But I think largely it's because their focus has been relatively internal. And we haven't kind of looked at the SOEs as big exporters. And I think that needs to be the focus on those energy companies. I don't know if Nick might want to add something you probably know.
Yeah, I just think there's been confusion. They've been very constrained, actually. It was only, I think, until about 3 or 4 years ago that they were able to actually look outside what was defined as core business. And, you know, I know of instances where some of the energy SOEs have actually invested in Silicon Valley venture funds to try and access clean technology when, from our perspective, it seemed rather disjunctive that they weren't actually deploying their capital into the New Zealand venture market. So I think really it's sort of a bit of a case that no one really was fully aware of the ramifications and the opportunities here.
So realistically, you've got, I mean, you're saying up to 65,000 jobs in renewable energy with some of these kinds of partnerships, but, I mean, you've got to get something that's viable and is going to work, and you've got to get these companies together with the entrepreneurs. I mean, 3 years doesn't seem like a very realistic time frame.
I agree with you, it's ambitious, that's true, but if you look at the expansion that's happening in the renewable energy sector, it's quite rapid. So the projections are, you know, $400 billion this year, $800 billion in 2015, the global renewable energy sector. If we were able to get 1%, that's all we're talking about, it's a very small fraction of the global market, then actually it does generate a lot of jobs in New Zealand. We need to act quickly. This thing isn't staying still. So it's like, you know, it's not like the world is kind of moving slowly on this. This is a rapidly expanding area. China is throwing the kitchen sink at renewable energy. If we want to get a cut of that, we need to be ambitious. The upside of being a small country in a large economy is that if you get a tiny part of a global market, it has a huge impact in New Zealand. So that's kind of why it seems like such a big deal in New Zealand, because the global market's so large. I mean, you could argue Finland had a similar experience with Nokia and telecommunications. They got a significant market share of a very large market, which then became a huge industry in Finland with mobile phone technology.
What you're talking about with the energy SOEs sounds very hands-on. Do you envisage them actually staying as SOEs? Because they aren't the arm's length at the moment, isn't it? The legislation requires you to be pretty hands-off. So are you going to change the legislation around that?
You wouldn't need to change the legislation. There's plenty of levers within the legislation as it stands in terms of the relationship between the government and the SOEs. Actually, there's plenty of people in the SOEs who actually want to do this. It's not like... I'm sure some of the SOEs are a bit, you know, slow off those, a bit slow to move, but actually there's heaps of people inside the SOEs who also see these opportunities. I mean, if you think about Mighty River Power, was it, 5 years ago they were trying to build another coal-fired power station up at Marsden Bay, up near Whangarei, and that got blocked by essentially the environment movement. And since then, they've made a huge turn into geothermal, and they've been building geothermal like it's going out of fashion. So there's a real appetite within the SOEs to actually engage in the renewable sector. And we've already started exporting renewable energy stuff across the Pacific, North America, Southeast Asia.
What's the difference between your policy of encouraging the SOEs to partner with the private sector in this regard and what Labor has been talking about for quite some time?
To some degree, there's real commonality. There is commonality between it. But for us, it's about the opportunities provided by the global green economy and actually really embracing that opportunity. So Labor did, as Nick was referring to earlier, change the rules towards the end of their government around what SOEs could do. But I actually think that we need to see this as one of the key drivers of our economy, so we need to be a bit more ambitious about it than that. And the renewable energy sector is just expanding rapidly. We need to get a bit of it.
Can I ask you about the paid conservation corps, putting a team of 3,000 paid conservation corps to work, planting, doing some of the things you talked about, like possum control. Do you think that $396 million over 3 years is good value for money for 3,000 jobs?
It's also about in terms, so we get the benefits there are in terms of jobs, but they're also in terms of carbon sequestration. So there's real benefits for New Zealand in terms of balancing our Kyoto books. Because while the government talks about the advantages at the end of 2012, you know, that our Kyoto account's going to be even, like I was saying before, we have got an ongoing problem, which is that forest is due to come down in the 2020s. So by actually doing some of this conservation work deals with some of the carbon issues. Obviously, forestry is a key part of it as well, but that's part of it. I'd also argue there's further spin-off in terms of brand protection. If we don't do the kind of brand protection that I think, you know, is envisaged in this package to create jobs, then we have a real risk of losing clean, green and safe, which is fundamental to our exports.
But it is an expensive measure, isn't it?
There are a number of things are expensive, there's no question. We've tried to keep the expensive measures as limited as we could, and we've tried to cost all the measures so that people can see how much it will cost and how much increased revenue we will take in, because I think, you know, these are straightened times, and so we've tried to be quite conservative about how much where we're spending money. But it's also true that we need to take advantage of the opportunities.
And where is the money coming from? Would it be new money? Would it be reprioritised in terms of the
So if you look at the package as a whole, there are clearly revenue streams within it, and I'm happy to talk through those, but there is considerably more revenue streams than there is extra spending.
Will there be spending up front though?
There will be some spending up front, yeah, but there's also some revenue streams up front, quite a lot of revenue streams up front.
But a lot of those revenue streams are, if not all of them, apart from maybe the capital gains, if you get Labor, are entirely unrealistic. I mean, National has made it abundantly clear that they're not a government that will introduce more tax. So that rather, you know, in that context, it's not such a modest spend, $4 billion, is it? I mean, and are you willing to kind of break the package down into much smaller pieces when you're sitting around the table negotiating a deal?
Obviously in any post-election negotiation, we'll be putting our priorities on the table, but you don't always get everything you want, and so we'll be looking at what's possible. Now, clearly, for example, the home insulation scheme, I would expect that would be something that National would be looking at extending. We haven't made an agreement about that, but I would expect so. It's been a very successful scheme. So there'll be things like that where you can say, yeah, that scheme's worked, we'll extend it. There'll be other areas where they won't agree with us, but, you know, that's the nature of post-election negotiation.
What would be the highest priorities?
In terms of what we've done is keep these three priorities, kids, rivers, jobs, so we would be putting all of those on the table, because we think getting kids out of poverty, it's the right thing to do, and it has enormous economic benefits because of the cost of inequality. And cleaning up our rivers is, you know, the right thing to do in terms of our environment, also has fantastic economic benefits, particularly in terms of brand protection. And these green jobs packages, I think there's some very practical ideas in here. And, you know, putting those on the table, I think, is part of the post-election process as well.
In terms of the jobs, though, leaving aside the home insulation, what are the priorities after that?
If you look at the kind of the government spending side of it, which is, you know, where the government has some, you know, direct say over things, you know, we've put together a number of those and we've put them all on the table, I think. If you're talking about just the government spending side of it, I mean, having an increase in investment in research and development, I think, is really critical to New Zealand. If we don't move from 1.3%, I think we'll continue to go backwards. I mean, it's hard for me to answer your question directly because, in a sense, we're putting a package on the table and you're asking me to break it down and kind of rank it. And I understand why you ask that, but what I'm saying is that we would be putting the package on the table. But, you know, the R&D spend really is an investment in our future.
And the three-parter thing is that you're talking about the government directly paying people to plant trees or $36 million being the cost of changing what the ETS to provide an incentive.
That part of the package is about providing a floor and a carbon price for the forestry sector. So a $25 a tonne floor for the carbon price in the forestry sector. It has certain risks because if the long run, if the price were to fall under that and then the government's guaranteed a floor price, we expect the price of carbon to increase over time. By providing a floor, you provide certainty to the forestry sector, and that's why you get such a big bang for your buck, if you like. It's because it's a relatively low investment, but you get a big return in terms of jobs.
And just finally, is this it? I mean, is this we've seen all the colour of the Green Party's election platform? Have you got more things that you want to announce close to the election?
This is most of it. There's a few, we've got a set of priorities, but these are the top three, if you like. We'll be announcing within the fiscal position that we've got here, there's a few things that will be announced within that, around a few other areas. But these are the top three. Sorry, what I mean to say was, but these are the top three. Kids River's jobs, right? That's our top three priorities. We have a number of other priorities, which actually the fiscal spend is contained within the budget we've presented. So we have some other priorities we'll be announcing around conservation, around transport and so forth. But we've tried to incorporate those within the overall fiscal position because we don't expect that we're going to be announcing lots of new spending.
Just on the total number of jobs you're talking about, do you see many of them coming out of like the non-green economy in terms of jobs that aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the realities of a modern market economy is there's constant churn, and so even if you do nothing, there's going to be the destruction of jobs and the creation of jobs, and so necessarily in the transition, what we're trying to do is create green jobs. There'll be other jobs, you know, as automatically happens in a market economy, that will become that will end, and so it's a matter of creating, make sure we've got those green jobs. Obviously, in the long run, the coal mining industry is going to be an industry that, if we're going to live within the climate constraints, that there can't be a huge future for the coal industry internationally. It's going to have a part. We're not suggesting close down existing mines, but we're not suggesting open new ones.
If there's 47,000 to 65,000 jobs in the renewables under, and if we hang on to state assets. If we don't, if we partially privatise them, have you done any numbers on what that number might come down to?
No, we haven't. The risk of partial privatisation is, I would argue, is that aside from everything else, is that you could lose control because partial privatisation can become a slippery slope, right? And so you lose control, and once you lose control, you don't necessarily have them headquartered or have the research and development in New Zealand. And you don't necessarily get viewed as a centre for exporting from, but rather as a profit centre. So a large international corporation will look at if it owns the New Zealand energy companies, will see that as a place to make money. It won't necessarily see it as a place to export renewable energy technology from. It might, but there's no guarantees if you don't own it. So that's the advantage of keeping it in public ownership.
You've acknowledged that there's a jobs target in terms of renewables. It might not be achievable. It's ambitious. It's had 3 years. Does that mean that the revenue stream over 3 years is pretty hefty, the amount of money? Is that so rather ambitious too?
Well, I mean, if you look at the breakdown of that revenue stream, so you've got the increased tax revenues from raising the minimum wage, that's pretty straightforward. You've got the levy on irrigation use, that's pretty straightforward. You've got capital gains tax, so we've suggested $1 billion over 3 years. So depending on how you want to, the tax working group talked about $4.5 billion when it was fully implemented per year. We've suggested $1 billion over 3 years because it takes time for a capital gains tax to come into play, and it depends what's going on in the economy. So we've taken a bit of a punt there. The temporary levy on earthquake levy is pretty straightforward. The earthquake levy is reasonably straightforward. And then we've reprioritised some government spending on new motorways. So, the government has this very large spending program. We're reprioritising some money away from new motorways. The phasing out and subsidies in ETS, additional mining royalties. I think they're all, I think that's pretty well quantified, actually. I think when you look at the revenue side of it, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, I'm happy to have a debate about any of those figures, but I think when you look at each of those figures, they're pretty sound. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.